Hello and welcome to The Music and the Movies, a program that looks at and listens to the sweet spot where music and movies intersect. In this hour, we ponder the special alchemy that happens when sound meets image, where music lovers and cinephiles come together. We explore a different theme in each episode, arranged around an idea or a person, and we delve into why some of our favorite movie moments are also musical ones. My name is Robert Horton. I'm a movie critic and historian and a member of the National Society of Film Critics. I'll play some music and talk about it in an attempt to get to the bottom of a lifelong fascination with why film is so especially intoxicating when music is involved. And at the end of each show, I'll round things off with the trailer, a particular cut that either didn't fit into the overall flow or has some special meaning to me or just so weird it deserves its own spot. So join us, won't you, for The Music and the Movies. Today's episode, Miklós Rozsa. Yeah, I thought we were due to spend an episode concentrating on a single composer of traditional movie music. And Miklós Rozsa described himself proudly as traditional. He also composed some of the greatest scores in film history. He happens to be a favorite of mine. When he died in 1995, I wrote an appreciation of his work for Film Comment magazine. And that gave me a reason to read his autobiography. It's called Double Life. Very enjoyable, sometimes irascible book. And the title refers not only to Rozsa's Oscar-winning score for the 1947 film, A Double Life, but to his own central division as an artist, to wit, while maintaining his status as a serious composer for the concert hall. In fact, for some years in Hollywood, he had it written into his contract that he would have 3 months off every summer to go away and work on his own music. He also did movies. And in fact, Rozsa was keenly aware that after a certain point in his career, he was really looked down on by his classical colleagues because he labored in the gilded vineyards of Hollywood. So today we'll listen to the different kinds of scores that he excelled at: adventure films, the exotic, film noir, I think on which he had a defining influence, and certainly the epic, especially of the biblical variety. We're not going to go in strict chronological order because I want to sort of generally group some pieces by style, but we will go mostly chronologically. And then at the end of the show for the trailer, I'm going to play a piece where Rozsa plays a classical music in-joke that involves the devil. Miklós Rozsa was born in Budapest in 1907. He was kind of a child musical prodigy as a performer, and he began composing in his teens. His road eventually led him to London. He was doing the music for a ballet there, and he kind of fell in with some film people, came to the attention of a fellow Hungarian emigre, the mighty producer, movie mogul Alexander Korda, who was at that time helping shape the character of British film. So, Rozsa had good reviews for his music up to this point, but not a lot of money to show for it. And when he realized there were other composers who supported themselves by writing for the cinema, he got very intrigued. His work for Korda in the movies, I think you could say it hit its zenith in 1940 with Korda's lavish production of The Thief of Baghdad, a film that got international acclaim, was especially noted for its very creative use of music. So let's get our listening started with a cue from that film. Miklós Rozsa himself said that he worked in a kind of an oriental mode, that's the way he put it, with some of these early projects. Certainly exotic is a good word for it, as you will hear with this cue, which is titled Procession from The Thief of Baghdad. Thank you. That's music by Miklos Roja from The Thief of Baghdad, taken there from an album of Roja's film music by the BBC Philharmonic. Not only did that film win an Oscar nomination for Roja, it also brought him to Hollywood, where he opted to stay when Europe went to war. Now, in the spirit of not going chronologically but grouping things by mood, let's consider another example of this exotic streak in the composer's projects. Led him to sometimes travel to the place he was writing about or research ancient and traditional instruments. And we'll listen to a track from the 1962 film Sodom and Gomorrah, which, as you might guess from the title, is a biblical epic from the period when Roja was really making hay in that genre. This is a cue called The Gates of Sodom, and it does sound like they're having fun in Sin City. A music cue from the film Sodom and Gomorrah, composed by Miklos Roja. One of Roja's most famous forays into exotic composing was his very busy score for another Korda production, The Jungle Book, in 1942, kind of a Carnival of the Animals thing going on in that film. And after that, he signed a contract with Paramount in Hollywood, and he was off and running on his American career. And Paramount, being at that studio, put him in proximity to Billy Wilder, who was trying to push the boundaries of what you could get on screen then. After doing Five Graves to Cairo with Wilder, Roja got Wilder's next movie, the hard-boiled Double Indemnity, in which the leads of the film would be heartless murderers. Here's what Roja came up with for the opening credits, and after we listen to this, we'll reveal what Paramount thought when they heard this. Thank you. as the opening theme for Double Indemnity, composed by Miklos Roja. The sound of impending death on a doom march as that opening credits goes on. According to Ed Sykov's biography of Billy Wilder, the chief of the Paramount Music Department said that the score was so unpleasant that it sounded like something from the Battle of Russia. But Wilder said to him, you may be surprised to hear that I love it, okay? And I guess that was that. One other person who loved the Double Indemnity score was Alfred Hitchcock, who wanted something new and unusual for his psychoanalytically flavored suspense romance film Spellbound. With Ingrid Bergman as a psychiatrist trying to heal the haunted Gregory Peck. So he got his producer, David O. Selznick, to hire Roja, who fulfilled Hitchcock's request for a big sweeping love theme and a note of madness in the score. Here are two cues from the score, the first being part of the main title music, which contains that big sweeping love theme, which is one of Roja's most famous melodies. The second piece is called First Meeting, and in that one, you'll hear the way a cheerful melody is replaced by the warnings of that wonderful electronic instrument, the theremin. two musical cues from Spellbound, performed there by the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra from an album that recreates the entire score of the film. You're listening to The Music in the Movies. I'm the host, Robert Horton, and we're listening to the career of the great composer Miklos Rozsa. Spellbound, by the way, is not one of my favorite Hitchcock films, I have to say. Maybe because the master of suspense was really the master of ambiguity, and Spellbound is a film that's all about removing ambiguity and, you know, solving the problems and healing people. But the music is strong, and that won Rozsa an Oscar for Best Score. That was 1945, by the way, and it was not the only Miklos Rozsa score to have a theremin in the soundtrack, as you just heard there. Billy Wilder brought him in to score The Lost Weekend, a harrowing study of alcoholism. And Wilder, at that moment, was in a bad spot because a preview audience had laughed at the film, and they thought they had a giant disaster on their hands. Rozsa looked at it and felt that the mistake had been to show the film with a temporary track of pre-existing music. That happens all the time in the movie business. But the music they had was sort of a jaunty jazz score, and the audience had been led to expect a different kind of film. Instead, Miklos Rozsa created a very dark musical canvas, including more theremin, plus a bizarre cue for the sequence when Ray Milland's character has the DTs. And it was crucial in establishing the seriousness of the film. It went on to be a big success, won the Best Picture Oscar that year. Here's a section from a suite of music from The Lost Weekend. This is a cue called The Weekend Begins. Music from The Lost Weekend by Miklos Rozsa, performed by the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, including a bit of the theremin. Now, we mentioned Double Indemnity, and that movie helped set the tone for that shadowy, doom-laden style known as film noir. And Miklos Roja did more in that vein. We're going to listen to a little bit of that now. First up, the main title music to The Killers, 1946, a crime film that takes its first 10 minutes from the Ernest Hemingway story of that title and then kind of goes off in its own direction. And there's a footnote to culture history here as we listen to this main title music. The four-note theme that you'll hear right at the start of the piece and then repeated later is the same four-note blast that began every episode of Dragnet a few years later, first on radio and then on for many years on TV. And when it became clear how popular Dragnet was going to be, you know, copyright lawsuits started getting filed, and eventually it was proved that the Dragnet composer, Walter Schumann, was on the soundstage when The Killers was recorded. So it was hard to get around that little borrowing there, and eventually the copyright got shared by the two composers, and they worked it out. But you're going to hear that bit right away in this music from The Killers. Music by Miklos Roja from The Killers, with Dragnet just a gleam in Jack Webb's eye at that point. Roja did his share of mood setting in the noir world, including the scores to Desert Fury, that's a weird color noir, and Crisscross, that's an excellent one, as well as the memorably titled Kiss the Blood Off My Hands. This is The Music and the Movies. I'm your host, Robert Horton, and we are listening to movie music composed by the Hungarian-American composer Miklos Roja. The Asphalt Jungle was made at MGM, where Roja had signed a contract in 1948. Not only was he allowed to continue teaching at USC during these years, but as we mentioned earlier, Roja was determined not to let his work in concert music flag, so it was written into his MGM contract that he would have 3 months off from the movies each year. Roja was doing things other than noir and the epic movies that he would soon tackle. We'll talk about those in a minute. So let's listen to examples of these other forms. Here's a piece from the 1947 film The Red House. Strange, spooky sort of rural melodrama with gothic overtones. This cue is called The Morgan Farm. It suggests the composer's touch for pastoral scenes, but with something troubling lurking in the background. Thank you. Miklos Roza's music from The Red House, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, and a re-recording of the entire score. For another note, here's a maritime score, the opening title music from a distinctive Fritz Lang-directed film from 1955, Moonfleet. Listen to how easily Roja adopts the contours of a pirate movie, but still gives it his big, dark signature sound. Music from Moonfleet. And to emphasize the variety that Roja could handle, here's another MGM production that demanded yet another mood. Lust for Life is the story of Vincent van Gogh, played by Kirk Douglas, colorfully and intensely directed by Vincent Minnelli. In the cue we'll hear, which is titled Madness, Roja creates a storm of music for the disintegrating artist, and the job of the film composer, you know, to express the inner life of a character, is potently demonstrated.
Thank you.
That piece is called Madness, from the 1956 Van Gogh biopic, Lust for Life, performed by the Frankenland State Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer himself, Miklos Rozsa. Another thing about MGM was that the Prestige studio made some very big movies, thus bringing Rozsa into his epic phase. A breakthrough in this department was Quo Vadis, a Roman swords and sandals melodrama from 1950, which not only served up a huge amount of big brassy music, but also resulted in one of the earliest examples of an LP soundtrack album, a relatively new concept, then becoming a bestseller, proving that there was a market for movie music in the long form. Let's hear another epic score, a different one, this time the 1961 film El Cid, which because of its status as a Spanish epic, gives Rozsa the chance to draw in Spanish influences, which he closely researched, as you will hear in that film's overture. Yes, we are in the epic realm. That's the overture from El Cid, performed by the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra. A reminder that if you have Charlton Heston in your movie, the music needs to be large. Which brings us to the biggest of the sword and sandals epics, Ben-Hur, from 1959, winner of 11 Oscars, including another one for Rozsa. In some ways, this movie and music get to the heart of what I yammer about in the intro that plays on this show every week, and about how intoxicating film and music can be when they match up. This is especially true because I don't actually think Ben-Hur is that great a movie. I actually find it kind of slow, It has a certain amount of widescreen self-importance, rather rife with hokum at times, I think I can say. But obviously there are great moments in it, you know, the chariot race, okay? But overall, I have to say it's Hollywood cornpone by way of the Gospels. And yet, it does things that movies do that nothing else can do. And so here's a couple of cues that will illustrate my conflicted point. When Chuck Heston's nobleman has been shunted off into slavery, he crosses paths with someone who reaches out to him and gives him water in a very touching scene. And the Lew Wallace novel, Ben-Hur, is, you will recall, subtitled A Tale of the Christ. So we can guess who this person is, even if the director, William Wyler, opts not to show his face. But we'd know it anyway from Miklos Rozsa's music, because this musical gesture is truly divine in its shimmering harmonics. That cue is called the Prince of Peace Part 1. We're going to listen to a little bit of that, and then that'll be followed by the more raucous Roman galley, which puts you in the guts of a ship where the slaves pull the oars. Two selections from the Ben-Hur original soundtrack recording. That latter one, you can practically feel the long pulls of the oars in the slave galley. Going back to the first one and my comments about how it hits the bullseye when it comes to the ridiculous meeting the sublime and how music can instill an emotion that can bowl you over, even when it's against your best instincts. In my piece on Rozsa for Film Comment, I said of this moment, the layers of harmonics that accompany Jesus as he doth give Charlton Heston to drink, that corny device of not showing the Lord's face, Rozsa's oral equivalent of heavenly light. I hate myself for being stirred by it, but God help me, I am. It's somehow deeply connected to the madness that is loving movies. So I guess what I'm saying there is that without the music, this scene might not be convincing. It's still a long shot when we finally see the Christ from behind with his perfectly straight long hair, just like you see him in the ads. But when the music and movies work together, something about that is beyond reason. And you are listening, within or without reason, to the music in the movies with Robert Horton talking about composer Miklos Rozsa. In that Film Comment article, I also say, if we went back in a time machine to ancient Rome and heard their actual music, we'd probably complain that it didn't sound like Miklos Rozsa. Here's an example of that. A triumphal march titled Parade of the Charioteers, and you know the big chariot race is right around the corner. More music from Ben-Hur.
We'll be right back.
Parade of the Charioteers by Miklos Roja from Ben-Hur. And while I'm not saying that there aren't a million different kinds of movie music, I am saying that that, folks, is movie music. But let's get out of the epic form for one of Roja's greatest moments in film. In 1970, after his style of composing had frankly become a little bit old-fashioned for that new 60s kind of movie, a project brought together Roja's classical music composing and his movie work. Billy Wilder, who was an erudite fellow, also a vulgar fellow, which is not a bad combination for a movie director, remembered Roja's violin concerto, which was composed for Jascha Heifetz in 1953, thought it might make an ideal theme to associate with the character at the center of his new film, a violin-playing consulting detective by the name of Sherlock Holmes. And so Roja reworked the concerto, which Wilder listened to while he wrote the screenplay, even allowing the movie to imply that Holmes himself may have composed it. The feeling of melancholy around Sherlock Holmes is conveyed by Roja's music, which is Wilder's way of tipping his hand with music, I think. Here's a suite, sometimes titled Gabriel's Theme, made from the concerto for the film.
Thank you.
Music from Billy Wilder's 1970 film, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. I think I forgot to say the actual title before setting that up. Composed by Miklos Roja, based on his violin concerto, performed by the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra. Well, things did slow down in Roja's movie career in the 60s and 70s, although he created lively work for The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, kind of a throwback to his exotica, one final one for Billy Wilder, Fedora, and a straight-faced score for the Steve Martin film noir spoof, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Our trailer selection today is going to allow Roja to do an in-joke. In his autobiography, this romantic composer declared his stubborn opposition to anything much avant-garde, including the kind of 12-tone composing that Arnold Schoenberg championed in classical music. Roja clung to tonality. He said, "I'm an unashamed champion of tonality. I've tried always in my own work to express human feelings and assert human values, and to do this, I've never felt the slightest need to move outside the orbit of the tonal system. Tonality means line. Line means melody. Melody means song. And song, especially folk song, is the essence of music because it is the natural, spontaneous, and primordial expression of human emotion." Well, he made one exception, though, when composing the score for King of Kings, The Life of Christ, that was nicknamed I Was a Teenage Jesus at the time for casting Jeffrey Hunter. It's kind of youth-oriented themes. Roja composed his only piece of 12-tone music for the appearance of Satan. He explained, in spite of, or rather because of my disbelief in Schoenberg's 12-tone system, I wrote the only 12-tone theme of my career for the devil. For me, 12-tone music is a stillborn idea, and thus naturally and admirably suited to the devil, the spirit of negation, the father of lies. This was an in-joke. I didn't expect a cinema audience to get the message, but thought it might rehabilitate me with the avant-garde. No such luck. Well, this piece, The Temptation of Christ, is bracketed by Roja's more familiar writing style and the main theme of King of Kings, but in the middle of it, you will hear him trying something more experimental as the devil appears. Music from King of Kings by Miklos Rozsa, and the composer's only fling at 12-tone music in film before reverting to his traditional mode there at the end. Well, in putting together this hour of music, I had to cut a lot of great selections, so please consider this just an introduction to a vast musical achievement. We'll go out to a little music from Rozsa's score to the 1976 Alain René film Providence, which itself has a different feel to what we've heard thus far. Miklos Rozsa had many different modes, though a lot of his basic themes have kind of similarities. When you're hearing a film noir score, you can get a hint of a Roman march, and when you're hearing one of his epics, you might pick up a touch of noir. It all works for one of the great composing careers in film. I'm Robert Horton, and I thank you for listening to The Music and the Movies.